Merci Enrico, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation. Thanks for the invitation. From now on, I'll be speaking in English, but of course, I'll be most willing to answer questions in French afterwards. Today, I'll be taking a few steps towards what might be called an anthropological philosophy of the media, given my dual training in philosophy and anthropology. The title of my talk is Life in the Media, From Immersion to Mobilization in the Digital Clinic. Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun, cries Nietzsche's madman in a famous parable of the gay science? Are we not continually falling? Aren't we straying as though to an infinite nothing? Isn't it empty space breathing at us? Hasn't it got colder? Modernity, argues philosopher Peter Sloterdijk in the introduction to his Spheres trilogy, may be considered as an attempt to drown Nietzsche's questions, or the madman's questions, in comfort. With its technical devices and air conditioning systems, the modern world aims to silence uneasy inquiries about the space in which we live in and from which we constantly fall. In the modern world, humans have lost the privilege of being in the interior. More than a mere declaration, that is, the death of God, the madman's anguish invokes the need for new forms of immunity, for new safety structures, for shell-less times. What is modernity, if not endless attempts at designing habitable, air-conditioned spaces out of the cold, open sky? Global connectivity thus introduces a recent version of an age-old anthropological challenge, as it points towards the emergence of spaces in which human lives are cared for and protected. However, it comes from unprecedented exposure to the outside, especially in the form of ambient risk and information overload. This blurring of the inner and outer boundary could be described as an internalization of the media, of the outside, or as a radical immersion in the media. The way I see it, to be in the media is to be constantly affected and to participate in processes which are larger than ourselves. Drawing upon the example of online disease tracking, in this talk, I will suggest that life in the media is characterized by attempts, endless attempts, at mediating an unprecedented exposure to the outside. That is, at enclosing the openness of a life that will not be contained. Life in the media is at once decentering and humanization of the self. In this regard, online disease tracking raises critical questions to whom I won't provide a definitive or straight answer, of course. One such question is that of the price to pay to ensure life against health-related risk when there is no more any clear distinction between inside and outside, or when the outside is internalized. At what point does protection from threat turn into control over life? And how can such life negation be avoided or resisted? Ultimately, online disease tracking hints at the challenge of how we are going to inhabit uncertainty together in the age of global connectivity. Okay, this was the introduction. From network science literature to everyday health settings, digital connectivity, as you know, has become highly correlated with protection against health-related risk and uncertainty. This is illustrated by the multiplication of web-based disease tracking systems. Put bluntly, such systems and platforms utilize web content to identify threats, calculate predictions, and warn about potential epidemic outbreaks. They are rapidly becoming a significant part of the epidemic surveillance landscape. One of the most eminent online disease tracking systems is, of course, Google Flu Trends. Google Flu Trends is an open tool for the early detection and daily monitoring of the influenza season. It monitors web searches of terms associated with flu to track influenza-like illness in a population. So basically, it tries to predict the actual epidemic activity relying on web searches, on people searching for their symptoms on us, for influenza-related symptoms online. And it works pretty well. Launched in 2008, it is specialized in the early detection and daily monitoring of the influenza season. To design its algorithms, Google took the 50 million most common search terms that Americans type online. They then compare these terms with data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, on the spread of seasonal flu from between 2003 and 2008. So they went back 5 years before. Google has found a strong correlation between a combination of search terms and the official figures of physician visits. On paper, then, Google Flu Trends has the capacity to record disease activity in near real time, and up to 1 to 2 weeks ahead of the CDC's official reports. However, Flu Trends has had its ups and downs. Put simply, over the last few years, it has often heavily overestimated, always overestimated, flu-related illness. This was especially the case around the peak of flu seasons, when such data is most useful. The discrepancy between flu trends and the numbers reported by the CDC have been acknowledged by Google on several occasions, which is quite rare with Google. But in the case of flu trends, they acknowledge that they had some problems with their algorithms. These discrepancies have been discussed extensively, and it is not my purpose today to provide an overview of these discussions. However, I would like you to note that the primary issue with flu trends is the fact that it is susceptible to false alerts prompted by unforeseen surges in flu-related search queries. Put loosely, flu trends aims to monitor health-seeking behaviors in the form of queries to online search engines. It aims to monitor people who are actually sick. However, the relationship between health-seeking behaviors and search queries is, of course, not straightforward. Not all queries signal disease. Queries signal other ways to be in the media, from rumor spreading to cyberchondria, and so on. The challenge, then, for flu trends is to differentiate queries that signal a specific health-seeking behavior from ambient noise. While flu trends does not lack sensitivity, never misses a signal. Rarely misses a signal, which is sensitivity. There are concerns over its specificity, which is picking up a false signal. Flu trends is, in this regard, the problem of overestimation basically hints at issues in the translation by flu trends of noise into something that can be accounted for, which is actual disease activity. Flu trends is, in this regard, particularly susceptible to mass panic searching, for instance, during the Ebola outbreak, to mass panic searching and heightened media coverage. What is at stake is the transformation of singular events, sickness, death, fear, and so on, into cases amenable in a series amenable to calculation and prediction. This process of transformation suggests Anna Munster is one of enclosure, and I quote, "The move by network corporations such as Google from search to prediction, that is, from a relatively open and extensive scanning of the future by searching it to an intensive enclosure of a zone before it even occurs by predicting it." I believe with Hannah Munster that there are indeed good reasons to associate disease tracking with enclosure or the limitation of our relation to the future. Tracking does not merely anticipate. It configures, orders, regulates. Tracking models massive, inconceivable amount of data to extract patterns that we can comprehend. It turns the world we are exposed to into a searchable, mappable space. Put bluntly, tracking mediates. Mediation, however, here obviously does not refer merely to the conveyance of a datum from one domain or location to another. Borrowing from media theorist Marshall McLuhan and so many others after him, I rather suggest that mediation both produces the environment in which we live and through which we unknowingly apprehend ourselves. Mediation is constitutive of both individual sensorium and social life. This is a suggestion that has been developed by media anthropologist William Mazzarella, notably in his strong criticism of affect theory. Put bluntly, for those of you who are not aware, affect theory, which was developed a lot by Brian Masumi, Deleuzian scholar in Montreal. Put loosely, affect theory conceptualizes affect as the embodied and impersonal ability to affect and be affected. As Mazzarella notes in his criticism, affect is a domain of impersonal intensity, indeterminacy, and above all, potentiality, which the signifying logic of culture reduces or, in its terms, qualifies. It is indeed the case that, for affect theory, cultural mediation structures and limits the material affective intensity of experience. Accordingly, the work of mediation, and here of Lutrens, this work of making things legible or commensurable comes at a high price, according to affect theory. It comes at a price which is the loss of that which precedes or exceeds mediation. What is lost is movement, and most importantly, the body's potential to vary and resist. According to affect theory, then, cultural theory is thus always, anthropology as myself, cultural theory is thus always already dealing with a stable, yet impoverished, version of reality. Culture has always done its covering work over the body's potential. So Mazzarella's, an anthropologist, Mazzarella's criticism of affect theory targets this fundamental opposition between, on the one hand, affective immediacy and intensity, and on the other hand, symbolic mediation, or technical mediation as well. Above all, it takes aims with the idea of vitality-denying symbolization, premised a symbolization, which is premised this idea of vitality denying is premised on a radical distinction between vital potential and the death-dealing work of mediation. This is very important. Mazzarella, of course, is not arguing against the existence of affect itself. He is rather insisting that affect should not be conceived as a vital outside or other, exceeding cultural inscription, and thus holding the potential to resist its normalizing grasp. While acknowledging a gap between affect and mediation, he argues for a productive gap, namely a gap which is the site of a dialectical movement between the concreteness of life, or in its materiality, and the conceptual generalization that social life necessitates, for instance, through language, most generally through language, at least through language. This movement between alienation and identification, self-distancing, and self-recognition, according to Mazzarella, is to be understood as the necessary condition for becoming. In other words, not only does he dismiss the vitality-denying impact of mediation, but he argues against the possibility of an unmediated existence. Mediation comforts, basically, according to him. For Mazzarella, and it is also the case for so many cultural theorists, it's basically it's the basis of anthropology as a discipline, actually. So for Mazzarella, there is no becoming outside of mediation, linguistic, technical, and so on. All that is external to ourselves is always already constitutive of ourselves. The key issue at stake here, I believe, concerns ultimately the relationship between life and thought. It concerns the gap. How are affective intensity and representation concretely articulated? Is the relationship between life and thought all about negation? Is there anything exceeding the sayable or representation? And above all, what good is it for, the success? One of the most important or innovative contemporary thinkers to have tackled this question is, as I mentioned before, German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk. Clearly, Sloterdijk would not go as far as denying, as Mazzarella does, the possibility of an unmediated existence or perception. According to him, symbolic processes clearly do not exhaust our relation to the world. In fact, affective intensities occupy a prominent position throughout Sloterdijk's work. He speaks of the animated, impersonal spaces, which are spaces of affective resonance, magnetism, solidarity in very concrete bodily terms, all things that cannot be fully grasped by language. At the same time, acknowledges Sloterdijk, and this is where it's getting very interesting, he finds a middle position in between vitalist approaches to life potentials and the cultural anthropologist's work with language. At the same time, acknowledges Sloterdijk, our intelligence is organized in such a way that we still constantly attempt to represent the unrepresentable. Simplifications and mediations processes are constantly bridging the divide between sensory presence and symbolic possibility. The reason for this, according to Sloterdijk, has to do with the bearability of our confrontation with the real and ultimately with life itself. He's getting very Nietzschean on this aspect, and I'm getting there too. So this issue of bearability has occupied Sloterdijk since his early writings. It was particularly explored in a small book, an essay published in 86 and dedicated to the young Nietzsche, The Birth of Tragedy. It's called Nietzsche, Thinker on Stage. Put loosely, The Birth of Tragedy of Nietzsche is usually considered to be considered as a Dionysian manifesto. That is, a manifesto for the dark forces of a disordered Dionysian reality against the ordered Apollonian reality, relying on reason, control, and individuality. Namely, it's usually considered as a manifesto against the sober thought of philosophy. However, in contrast with such readings, Sloterdijk suggests that what Nietzsche aims to assert is not so much the triumph of the Dionysian as its compulsion towards an Apollonian compromise. The Dionysian element, pursues Sloterdijk, is never in power as such. Its dark driving force only raises to the surface provided it complies with the Apollonian compulsion to articulate, symbolize, and represent. In truth, suggests Sloterdijk, Dionysian energetics are always already in a situation of compromise, led by an Apollonian principle. We cannot, writes Sloterdijk, overlook the fact that this represents an extremely mediated and guarded form of playing with primordial forces, unquote. This mediated form of playing is no other than a compromise between the energetic and the semantic, between the affective and the mediated. Following such a compromise, things step outside of themselves. They appear in their second edition, as replacement, as a mediated version of themselves. Sloterdijk suggests that this is nothing less than the historical compromise of Western culture, following which thinking comes with a considerable sacrifice of one's wild lower half, of that which representation cannot account for. On the one hand, insists Sloterdijk, we should not too hastily celebrate the silencing of Dionysian power. In fact, Apollo himself had to compromise his illusions of self-control, which have now given way to endless concerns with its own lack of foundation, with what lies behind or beneath its foundation, beneath the forms. Through the Apollonian compromise, it's a very classical Nietzschean argument, but through the Apollonian compromise, the moral subject has lost its autonomy. It has been decentered. On the other hand, the compromise is not to be understood as a mere loss, and this is where Sloterdijk, I think, is very innovative. Usually, a compromise is always understood as a loss from most Nietzsche's readers. On the other hand, the compromise is not to be understood as a mere loss. In fact, Sloterdijk conceives of mediation, of this standing in place of something, as a process of beneficial substitution. That is to say, the compromise of mediation does not merely entail a negation of life itself, but also points toward the engendering of lives out of disorder. This can be emancipatory inasmuch as it places us, medial beings, at a protective distance from what is unbearable. Okay, the compromise of mediation, then, is a compromise for sustainable living conditions. This is, of course, not unique to the digital clinic that Flutrens instantiates. After all, since time immemorial, and anthropologists can testify for that, the protection of life has been tied with orders and techniques aimed at domesticating the monstrosity of an untamed world. Of course, Michel Foucault, because I'm speaking of the clinical work here, I have to say a word about Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault has, for instance, shown how the modern clinic emerges as a series of discursive, technical, and presubjective practices that bring human lives within the reach of empirical knowledge. Man, argues Foucault in The Birth of the Clinic, enters onto the horizon of visibility of modern knowledge through a specialization of that which life is opposed to and to which it is exposed, namely death. Throughout the work of Foucault, the conditions of man's existence is to be understood as a series of tensions, coincidences, and discontinuities between life and its limits. Foucault was of course sensitive to the anguish of Nietzsche's madman. He knew well enough that the relation between affective intensity and symbolic mediation, or language, is best apprehended in terms of viability. However, once we approach the compromise in such terms, it is no longer sufficient to assert that things cannot be represented in themselves and to insist on what is lost in translation. Neither can we simply replace ideals with other ideals, representations with other representations, helplessly trying to assure ourselves of our place in the world. Once it has become explicit that ideals and representations are the outcome of a compromise, an age-old anthropological question emerges: what becomes of the force that has motivated them? What become of the force which made the compromise necessary? The question I'm trying to raise here is obviously that of the insufficiency of mediation, including, of course, of online disease tracking. I aim to hint at the space and indeed at the physicality of thought, to suggest, as I do, that to be in the media is to be standing outside of oneself, is to suggest that it comes with an intensification of life that subsists its mediation into something bearable. In our age of global connectivity, I suggest that this intensification is widely experienced as mobilization, as the title of this conference says. As mobilization, I understand mobilization as pure movement. On every front, life is being put in motion. It is being sped up. Mobilization is the condition of ubiquitous connectivity, of immersion within media environments of all kinds. Increasing connectivity contributes to the generalized availableness of life, to the intensity of its movement. Mobilization, then, is a condition of relentlessness, of relentless involvements, that while not totally exhausting life, I'm precisely trying to point at the reminder here, so it does not totally exhaust life, but still, it may be wearing it and pushing it to the limit, to the point of depression, of existential depression and physical depression. Mobilization then raises the question of the viability of life at ever-growing velocities. Drawing on my previous discussion of mediation, the question is, how can mediation, and indeed digital media, contribute in our being at ease in movement? By being at ease, however, I do not mean stopping movement. The romanticism of pre-modern tranquility is of very little use here. In contrast, the reason why systems such as flu trends cannot be successful or at completely stabilizing or containing disorder is that movement comes first, and movement doesn't stop. It is only momentarily limited, gathering momentum. Disease tracking then, is not a waiting game. It is a matter of being upfront. It has to do with allowing and accelerating the circulation of certain things and not others. The enclosure or mediation of threat, of disease, of death, performed by systems such as flu trends, should then be apprehended as part of a broader attempt at domesticating excess. This, I believe, is most obvious in times of epidemics, and this is precisely when flu trends stops working. In times of epidemics, there is an apparent rupture of equilibrium. Levees break. Media stories about necessary precautions, maps of contagion risk, projections of how the virus might spread, all converge into the fact that one cannot avoid feeling overexposed. As outbreaks are apprehended as potentially global exterminators, space is getting closer, getting denser. Connectivity becomes correlated with processes of insulation and self-monitoring, for instance, of monitoring of one's movement and contacts with people. Epidemics pass through bodies. Flows trigger a spiraling insecurity. Insecurity converts into self-strengthening and auto-excitation. In other words, insecurity mobilizes. The porosity of borders nourishes fears of invasion and of contagion. We've all experienced that precisely 1 year ago when I was here in Paris working on this Ebola epidemic. Travelers become suspected plague bearers. Caregivers are expected to self-track and self-isolate. Checkpoints multiply, whether it be in airports, hospitals, or online. Surveillance and tracking devices proliferate. And I quote, "This is the app you want around you to keep track of this deadly outbreak," advertises the Ebola Tracker iPhone application. There were over 150 applications related to Ebola tracking during the outbreak. Healthy individuals start Googling symptoms they do not have. Traffic on Twitter, social media, and Google densifies, making it harder and harder to translate ambient noise into meaningful signals. Online data no longer translates into relatively predictable patterns, for instance, into patterns which are comparable with previous years. Under such circumstances, the relationship between tracking, immersion in the media, and exposure to threat is rendered visible. By placing the body in the midst of the media, immersion always comes with a risk of overexposure to others, to what is to the common, basically. Paradoxically enough, overexposure is precisely what seems to undermine tracking devices such as flu trends, which depend on minimal exposure, but they still depend on our exposure. If we're not aware that there's, we still need to be there working online. We still need to be aware that our situation might be related to influenza. As flows of contaminating fear rev out of control, it becomes evident, still speaking of epidemics, it becomes evident that tracking struggles, flu trends struggles at capturing the happenstance inherent to overexposure to others. It also becomes evident that tracking both defends life through the enclosure of prediction. So it defends life from overexposure and also bears the risk of negating life. Okay, I'll go with the conclusion. I'll skip a few parts. Life is a window of vulnerability. It seems a mistake to close it, wrote Donna Haraway in the Biopolitics of Postmodern Bodies. Vulnerability, suggests Haraway, is a window unto life. To keep the window open, however, entails to distance ourselves from fantasies of fully defended, victorious selves. In contrast, Haraway conceives of immunity in terms of shared specificities of semi-permeable individual and collective selves that are able to engage with others, that is, to engage in a world replete with non-self. 25 years later, Haraway's sharp criticism still resonates strongly. What are online disease tracking systems if not attempts at abstracting bodies, individual and collectives, from their constitutive vulnerability? This leads us back to our initial problem. At what point does protection from threat turn into a negation of or control over life? When does overexposure to the world translates into a loss of world, to speak a Heideggerian language? Or more specifically, how can we design spaces and develop techniques aimed at sustaining an increase in openness to the world? I insist on the world sustaining, at developing a sustainable openness to the world. In answering such a thorny question, I would like to suggest that at least two pitfalls shall be avoided, desperately avoided. The first pitfall is that of a closed semantic circuit premised on the conviction that there is nothing overwhelming enough that it cannot be mediated. That is, that there is nothing overwhelming enough that it cannot be dissolved into anthropocentric self-assertion. That is, this first pitfall, of course, is regrettably the all-too-common pitfall of over-humanization. The second pitfall that should be avoided is basically the contrary, is the notion of a smooth opening premised on a romantic idealism in which the labors involved in mediation are evacuated. This pitfall, quite common in neo-vitalist approaches, confuses our standing outside of ourselves with absolute indifferentiation. It is thus complicit with mobilization. Ultimately, what is common to these suggestions is a need to come to terms with a conception of the media which negates the exposed character of existence. Only through careful relations with something that dangerously exceeds us may we possibly enhance our participation in the creative affirmation of life. Thank you.
C'est à propos de cette distinction que tu fais entre le switch to English, your distinction between affective intensity on the one hand and symbolic mediation on the other end. I wonder that it's in some passages of your talk, it seems that this is a distinction between perception on the one hand and language on the other end. I wonder whether there is this correspondence or not, and the role that pictures plays in this distinction. Since pictures seems to be perceptual, not linguistic, but on the other hand, they are not perception, or at least it depends. There are theory of transparency according to which television pictures or especially things like video conference or Skype and stuff like that are forms of real perception, even if mediated, just as we have perception through glasses or telescopes, and so we can have also perception through devices that convey pictures. So, the role that pictures can play in the field on which you focus, that is the health field.
Well, I think that this I try to problematize this radical binarization between affective intensities on the one hand and cultural mediation through pictures or other technical means on the other hand. I try to make this gap narrower in a way. But of course, this to start from there is a bit provocative. I agree. I find it very enlightening for me as an anthropologist. We start with cognitive and linguistic. We basically understand culture usually through a language related symbolization, and I think this is a provocative way to try to get to, for instance, our bodily involvement in the world in a way which, to me, always exceeds, at least partially, or the linguistic terms of this engagement. So, for instance, if you see a picture, of course you can always argue, as Mazzarella does, that your all relation to this picture is always already mediated by, for instance, your culture, your religion, where you grew up, your socialization. But you can also argue in a Deleuzean fashion, as effect theory says, that there is something which gets straight to your gut, that gets to your body, regardless of any form of mediation. So basically, it's a huge anthropological question of the articulation of life and thought. I take the example of Sloterdijk. He does not use picture as an example. He uses, for instance, meditation. This is only one example. He is a possible way to have a contact with something which is unmediated. So basically, the question I'm trying to deal with here is what part of it is precognitive or precultural, understood in very, very broad terms. And when one thinks of the internet, for instance, or even of a picture, for instance, is a picture of a symbol of any kind triggering mass panic, for instance? Is it trigger? We have to go back to crowd theory. I'm reading Elias Canetti, for instance, to better understand how crowds behave, how in ways which are completely trans-individual, which have very little to do with the addition of enclosed individuals. And I think there's something of that in the internet as well. For instance, through virality, through the way people just behave or respond in a very effective way, which goes beyond the message itself. Well, that's why McLuhan says the medium is the message, basically. He was having the medium in his, the way he understood it, was a very sensorial, not really a cognitive thing.
Okay.
But I'm sorry not to speak more about the picture, which I do not know much about the picture itself. But I believe that both are involved, completely intertwined in our experience or perception of pictures. You okay. cannot do without one of these two, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we were discussing about that yesterday evening, but I wonder how would you reply to the fact that what you said about the Google Fruit Trends works really good in the case of Google Fruit Trends, for example. So Google Fruit Trends doesn't work in these cases of emergence. But there are other tools like Twitter data collection that works really good in the case of emergencies, like in earthquakes or in events like concerts. So data Twitter collection, for example, works really good in this emergency situation, but it doesn't really work when it's a regular situation. So it's rather the contrary than the Google Fruit Trends. Mm-hmm. So how would you explain these differences? So I'm wondering if what you said about the tools is concerning just the tool itself, but not other tools. So that's my question.
I'm not saying that tools cannot hint at something happening. I'm calling what the problem with flu trends is prediction. Is that flu trends is working over years? It's not just at this very moment. It's not just trying to say right now there's something happening here. It tries to predict what is good 2 weeks before. And in order to do that, it has to rely on precedent, on previous years. So the matter is a matter of continuity. There's a rupture when there's something happening. And however they tweak their algorithms, because of course they've been trying to do that for 6 years now, to tweak the algorithms to take into account the possibility of a surge in search inquiries. And this is, to me, the most interesting aspect of it. How it is basically impossible for them, so far at least, and I believe it will never be, to take into account, to account for a possible surge. And I don't think that the Twitter and other things are doing the same thing at all. They're not trying to do that. No, there's no prediction at all involved, and there's no... So they don't care at all about any form of continuity in their algorithms. It's just a matter of saying, well, some people saying something's happening here, and they're not used as much either. I think there's one of the issues with flu trends is that they're used also by national health agencies, and especially, well, I didn't go. There's also Google dengue trends, right? So there's not only flu trends. So dengue trends is used in countries, for instance, where they do not have a good national monitoring systems, so they use Google's infrastructure a lot, and then so the issues are, it provokes health-related issues, which Twitter does not. Yeah.
Merci beaucoup, Vincent, pour ton intervention.